Welcome to This Is Money podcast. I'm Georgie Frost, and alongside me and editor Simon Lambert today is assistant personal finance editor Helen Crane. And coming up, the mortgage battle steps up with rates continuing to fall. When will they hit bottom, and could you save by switching? Meanwhile, are you a super snooper? Just why are we so interested in what other people have paid for their houses? Also today, gracias Vodafone, pero qué sorpresa. Vodafone joins EE in reintroducing roaming charges. What can you do about it if you're heading abroad? We also ask if you're too emotionally attached to your investments. We talk behavioral economics, plus fractional shares, should you invest, and why music rights are such big business. Don't forget to stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. But first, the mortgage battle continued this week as HSBC joined Halifax in coming out with some super low two-year fixed deals. We're talking in the 0.8 to 0.9 region here. There are now multiple deals available at around that figure. So as you would expect, they're reserved only for those with a hefty deposit or equity, but it's led to questions over how much further rates could fall. Some brokers are suggesting they could go as low as 0.5%. So This Is Money's taken a look at the market, spoken to the experts. And before we get to the nitty-gritty with Helen, why are we here, Simon?
Well, we're in a situation where as the coronavirus crash hit and lockdown arrived, it was imminent actually, it's before it arrived last year, the Bank of England slashed interest rates. And it wasn't alone. The central banking glitterati, I shouldn't call them the Illuminati, I nearly did. The central banking glitterati decided that the thing to do again in the face of crisis was to slash interest rates and also to lob a load of money at the financial system in the form of quantitative easing and other such unconventional measures. Now, what that is aimed at doing is dragging down interest rates that banks offer people, so lowering the cost of borrowing. And the idea is that if you lower the cost of borrowing, then there will be more demand for it. So if you make something cheaper, more people will want it. Therefore, more people will involve themselves in borrowing to do stuff. Companies will involve themselves in borrowing to do stuff, and that should grease the wheels of the economic engine and help to battle the crisis, which is a different method of tackling it to, for example, furlough, which involved paying 80% of people's wages up to a certain amount. That's effectively just handing people money. This is a lot more indirect. Now, what tends to happen is if you are in a panic situation, which, let's face it, we were 18 months ago, just cutting those rates, the base rate, Federal Reserve, etc., doesn't necessarily immediately lead through to the banking system cutting the cost of loans and going, hey guys, do you want to borrow some more of money? Because they're also battening down the hatches. And you actually saw banks set aside large amounts of money in kind of spring last year to go, okay, we're going to get a wave of defaults, a wave of bad debts. This is going to be economically very bad. That's going to impact on us, and we need to be cautious. And banks are considerably more cautious now than they were, for example, in the run-up to the financial crisis. So they were in a much better position to soak up any problems. Now, actually, it turned out that despite the GDP crash that we saw and the economic crash and the fact that many people suffered hugely economically, actually it probably wasn't quite as bad as people thought, particularly for the banks and for people like homeowners, people with loans and debts and things. I mean, we had all kinds of stuff like mortgage holidays and things, didn't we? So the banks found themselves in a slightly better position than they thought they were, and they also discovered that the housing market, unbeknown to everybody, didn't crash. Everybody expected it to crash, to absolutely tank. This would be the thing that finally knocked house prices off their perch. But the opposite has happened. So initially you had a delayed reaction. Mortgage rates didn't really shift. So I took out a mortgage just over a year ago, 5-year fixed rate mortgage, in order to buy a home. And the rate on that was 1.4%. Because I'm in a fortunate position where we've got quite a lot of equity. Now that had barely shifted from what the rates were before the interest rate cuts. And I was sitting there waiting for the rate to come down and badgering my broker saying, has the rate come down yet? Has the rate come down yet? And in the end, I just obviously had to take 1.4% because I didn't have any choice. I had to buy the house. Then we started to see the mortgage battle that was occurring before coronavirus step back into gear, maybe around the end of summer, start of autumn last year. And then you started to see rate cuts. And then it's really accelerated this year because the housing market is booming. There's more transactions. House prices are up lots. That makes banks and building societies feel that bit more confident in lending people money. They're still awash with cheap cash. They've got loads of cheap savers money. Savers have done, you know, the lockdown saving phenomenon where people have built up savings balances. There's an estimated extra £200 billion has been saved by the Bank of England. And a lot of that is just sitting in low rate accounts. And that helps banks to fund their mortgages. It's not as simple as they take that money and they lend it out, but it helps them to fund their mortgages. And also their balance sheets haven't been as badly affected. So actually you've started to see them release some of that money that they'd set aside. All of this creates a scenario where you get mortgage rates being cut because they are competing for borrowers. Now, they're not in exactly the same position they were before coronavirus, where banks and building societies appear to be more keen to lend people money than people were to borrow the money. But they are very keen to lend people money and people are quite keen to borrow it at the moment. They're just cutting rates more on the higher deposit loans. So if you've got more money to put down, you're seeing the best rate cuts. And if you've got less money to put down, you're not seeing them that are quite as good, but you are seeing some rate cuts. And to put a point of comparison, the same 5-year fixed rate mortgage with the same bank that I took one out a year ago with is now 1.04%. And actually, the cheapest ones have snuck below 1%, 0.99%, with Nationwide is the cheapest. I think HSBC is doing one of those as well. So it's astonishingly cheap money.
Helen, what's your take on the situation?
Yeah, agreed. It's that the rates are extremely cheap at the moment. This week, we've seen HSBC has come out with its own lowest rate ever, which is 0.89% on a 2-year fix. Very, very low. And just a few days before that, Halifax launched what is possibly the cheapest ever mortgage, 0.83% on a 2-year fix as well. It's a great time if you're looking to remortgage. But Simon's right, these rates are very much reserved for people with the highest deposits and equity. So the HSBC rate, it's for people with 40% deposits or above. It also has a £999 arrangement fee. So yeah, these rates, they do come with big fees attached to kind of mitigate that a little bit. The super low Halifax deal as well, it has a fee of, I think, about £1,200. And it's also only available via selected brokers. So you're not going to probably see it if you're kind of searching around on online calculators and things like that. So yeah, they're good deals, but very much reserved for a small kind of proportion of homeowners. Yeah. There, you've got to watch out for some of the sort of fees and the catches as well.
Well, that's, I want to ask you, I mean, in terms of 999 or 1,200, how does that fit within what you would expect to pay for the fees? And also, can you get under 1% if you don't have 40% deposit or equity? I mean, where are we looking for those who have perhaps a smaller deposit?
Sure. So you can get a 0.99% with no fee. Just so, I think Platform has a deal on 0.99% without a fee, but they're very rare. You do normally have to pay a chunky fee, and they can be anything between about £750 and all the way up to £1,500. So, you know, they can be a lot, and you have to factor that into your calculations. So work out how much you'd be paying per year on your mortgage and then factor the fee into that. So it can actually end up that, you know, you're better off paying a higher rate with a lower fee. So I did some sums based on a borrower buying a £300,000 home with a 40% deposit, so £120,000. Their total mortgage would be £180,000. If they took out the Halifax super low 0.83% deal, they would be paying £8,725 a year on a 2-year fix. But actually, if they took out a much less glamorous 1.12% rate with Barclays without a fee, they could actually save £450 a year. You've got to do your sums.
Get the calculator out, exactly. Yeah. I want to know what you should consider when switching, because of course these rates sound super attractive. Is there ever an argument, because of course you have these fees to pay perhaps if you leave your deal early, but actually is there ever an argument that once you do the maths, it could work out better for you to sort of suck up some of those fees and go anyway?
Yeah, there is an argument for that. I think for most people who are in the middle of a fixed term, that probably isn't going to be the case. You know, early repayment charges can be, they're normally about sort of 10% of the amount you borrowed. So they're quite hefty. But brokers are saying there are situations where it could save customers money, but it's mostly for people who have quite expensive properties. I'd say, yeah, probably chat to a broker if you think you might be in that situation. But for most people, if you factor in the early repayment charge, it's probably not going to be worth switching. On the other hand, if you're coming towards the end of a fixed term, you're kind of the envy of everyone because it's a great time to remortgage and you can very likely save money. But if you are stuck in a fix, it's perhaps better to just kind of stay put considering the fees that you'd have to pay.
Yes, and to put that into context, being 1 year into a five-year fix, I looked at this and how much money we would have saved if we'd had the 0.99% deal that was the absolute best you could get nowadays, and it would theoretically save us £72 a month, which is £3,456 in total over the remaining 4 years. Now, that's nothing to be sniffed at. I would rather I had the money in my pocket rather than the bank having it in its coffers. It's always worth saving money, but it's definitely not worth sucking up a £16,000 early repayment charge. No. That we would have to pay in order to get out of our mortgage to take it. That would be the classic false economy. And lots of people will find themselves potentially in a similar position if they're not very far into a five-year fix. And actually, in fact, some five-year fixes have quite hefty repayment charges running nearly all the way to the end. With a two-year fix, you'll probably find it all the way through. People who might possibly like to consider it are those on something like a lifetime tracker who've been sitting there on rates that have been really quite low because they track the base rate, which if you take out new deals like that, they're not so attractive nowadays. But some of the historic ones, some of the ones that date back some time, but they might be worth them looking at remortgaging onto one. If they're thinking that they're not going to be moving in the next, you know, 5 years, then, you know, for example, the mortgage that we had before we sold our flat and moved last year, we were paying something like 2.5% or 2.25% on or something. It was a lifetime tracker. Now, you know, absolutely, if we'd have been staying in the same property and sticking around there for another 5 years, it might have been worth jumping ship to a five-year fix at 0.99%.
Helen, you've been speaking to the experts about where they think rates are heading next, because whenever I talk about this, I think about Lee many years ago when we first started out the podcast, talking to me about how blink and you'll miss a 2 year fix. It's over before you know it. And then you have to go through the palaver of doing it all over again. And actually, he's a big fan of a 5 year. Simon's got one. Are they going to go much lower to even make it worth it? What should you be thinking about? Should you get a 5 year fix? Where do the experts think it's going to go? Up, down, sideways? I don't know.
Yeah, so I kind of canvassed a few brokers about this, where they think rates are going. And frustratingly, there was absolutely no consensus whatsoever. So some said that they think rates are very close to bottoming out. They're not going to go much lower at all. Perhaps banks will focus instead on making deals a bit better for people in the middle of the market rather than continuing to slash them for those people with the most equity. However, other brokers said they have further to go, could potentially even go as low as 0.5%, which would be completely unprecedented. Honestly, I think people just don't know. One of the brokers told me, if anyone tells you they know where rates are going, they're lying.
Yeah.
So, I mean, if I had to put money on it, I would say they would perhaps edge a little bit lower. I think 0.5% is, personally, I don't think they're going to go that far. you know, it's been a crazy year, and you do never know. In terms of looking at a 5-year fix, as you said, I think people in the UK are quite averse to them. They do tend to prefer to go for 2-year fixes. Rate wise, it probably does sound like quite a good idea at the moment. The rate gap between 2 and 5 year fixes is quite slim. HSBC has quite a good deal for those with a 25% deposit, 1.19% with a £999 fee, which is a good deal. But then, you know, you've also got to think, if you might be thinking about moving in the next couple of years, your circumstances might change. It's perhaps better to go for a shorter fix, and you can port your mortgage, but it gets a bit complicated if there's sort of a big difference in price and things like that. Another thing to consider is the fees, though. So if you're on a 5-year fix, you're not going to have to pay any arrangements fees for another 5 years, where if you take 2 2-year fixes in that time, that could be another, you know, grand and a half of fees. So yeah, there's arguments for and against, but rate wise it certainly looks like quite a good idea at the moment if that fits your circumstances.
So, Simon, lie to me. Where are rates going?
Well, you'd think that the only way is up, wouldn't you? But who knows? You would think that certainly for base rate, the only way is up. I think we're probably in a scenario now where we've shrugged off the worst of the immediate crisis, and there's talk of tightening monetary policy in order to deal with the perceived threat of inflation rather than loosening it further. That doesn't mean that mortgage rates won't come down, because as we just discussed, mortgage rates didn't come down really by any meaningful amount after the base rate was slashed, and then the base rate stayed the same and they did come down. It's to do with competition and lenders being eager to lend and people being eager to borrow. I mean, one very interesting thing is that we are, I think, running up against the limitations of how much money people can actually borrow. Fueled by the stratospheric jump in house prices over the past year, the result that nobody wanted from the crisis. Helen had a story earlier this week about there being, you know, the greatest number of mortgages above a 4 times salary being taken out. And there is actually a cap that the Bank of England has, you know, or the regulator has imposed upon banks and building societies, where they can only do a certain amount of business above a certain income multiple, even though mortgages aren't worked out on income multiples anymore, they're worked out on affordability. But that does sort of rein things in a bit, because my suspicion has always been that you'll get some kind of lending boom that gives the final leg up for the property market. I didn't think the thing that gave the final leg up for the property market would be a global pandemic where it was illegal to leave the house for most of the past year. But, you know, I'm regularly wrong on that kind of stuff. But I thought it would be they'd find some way of loosening. And the way of loosening, the easy way of loosening, is on affordability measures, they've got to see how much your incomings are every month and how much your outgoings are and whether they can afford to give you the mortgage. So you've got to find a way to make the mortgage payments cheaper. We've seen terms being extended. It used to be 25 years was the common term. It then went to 30, went to 35. We're now seeing people take 40. That has that effect of doing it. The other way of doing it is obviously cutting mortgage rates. How much lower can they go? The other way is doing something like starting up interest only again. Now, I don't think it's going to go to what it was before the financial crisis, where it was like, you know, if you borrow interest only, you could borrow much more money. And there was no like, how are you going to pay this back thing? I think we've had that moment, but there is definitely opportunities to do part and part, for example, and banks will accept you saying that you're going to sell your home at the end of the term as a means of paying off the interest only mortgage. Whereas post financial crisis, they weren't doing that anymore for people. And maybe we'd start to see interest only mortgages flicker in a bit. But the thing that will limit that is if this cap remains on, you can't lend to a certain more than to a certain chunk of people, more than a certain multiple of their salaries.
All right, we'll leave that to one side and move on. Kelsa Breeze. Before Brexit, roaming charges for customers were banned under EU law. Now, that is quite obviously no longer the case. Despite all the positive noises at the start when they said they had no plans to reintroduce them, Vodafone is the latest to fall. Helen, remind us, because it's probably been a while since we've been abroad, and been even longer since we've had roaming charges. What are roaming charges?
So So roaming charges are the fees you pay when you travel outside the UK with your mobile phone. You're charged to use your normal allowance of sort of minutes, text, data, whatever. You're essentially paying again for the privilege of using airtime that you've already paid for outside of the UK. So mobile phone firms used to be banned from charging customers extra fees to use their allowance in Europe, but that all changed after Brexit, and those rules don't apply anymore. Charges in the EU are now the same as you would have if you were travelling anywhere else in the world.
I remember reading the articles about the people whose bills have run into the thousands. I mean, these can be pretty eye-watering, can't they? Are we going to see a return to that? I suppose we could do.
Yeah, possibly. I mean, yeah, perhaps not right now because still most people aren't really going anywhere. But once that changes, yeah, absolutely. You know, we've run stories about people's bills running into the thousands. And it is easy to do for people who perhaps, you know, don't travel a lot, don't really check out what the charges are, and then just get absolutely stung. It is very easy to do.
So what have Vodafone announced? They're not the first. EE, I think, were the first to do this. But actually, because this is all about me, and I'm not with Vodafone or EE, I'm with O2. There's not a lot of noise about them, but they also have something. And I'm going away very, very soon. So I want to know what's happening with O2 as well. But it's not all about me. So let's focus on Vodafone and EE first.
Yeah. So, a few of the operators have now come out with their charges for people going abroad. Vodafone has basically said that there's going to be a £2 a day flat fee to any customers. It only comes into force when you sign up to a new contract or renew your existing contract. So you're probably okay for now, Georgie. You can also, when you do renew, you can opt for a special tariff that does include roaming, but obviously they'll be more expensive. Luckily, none of these changes come into force until January next year. So people heading away this summer should be okay on Vodafone. You can also buy kind of special passes for your holiday, so you kind of pay a few quid and you don't get stung by the charges. I mean, it's not great, but it's better than kind of getting stung by a big charge. In terms of other networks, most of them actually said initially that they weren't going to change their roaming charges, but they all seem to be quite rapidly sort of changing their minds. EE has said that it will charge new customers and those upgrading again from January a £2 daily fee to use any of their minutes or data outside of the UK. And O2 has said customers will be charged £3.50 for every gigabyte of data used over 25 GB. Mm. So that's quite a lot of data. So that's a bit more reasonable. You know, if you don't go over 25 GB, then you should be okay. So that's not one of the worst, but it's still, you know, it's very much something that you need to check if you're heading abroad, because, you know, you can really, it can really rack up.
I just think it's the thin edge of the wedge. Is that the expression where, you know, we're seeing little bits come in and doubtless we're going to see, it's just ways to get money out of us, and they can. So why would they not, I suppose? Helen, what can you do if you are heading away? Obviously these are coming in January, but I'm thinking beyond that. I mean, is it worth getting a SIM card at the place where you're going? Is that an option? I mean, is it worth switching to another provider, or are they all going to, like lemmings, fall off the cliff as well? I mean, you know, other things, remember to turn off, I guess, your roaming and download your Spotify tracks before you travel. It's stuff like that.
Yeah, I think sadly they will all pile into this and all start having some kind of charges. I guess if you're coming to the end of a contract and you do travel abroad a lot, it's probably worth checking out other networks and if they have slightly more kind of lenient charges, or if they have sort of special plans that you can get that do include roaming, it might be worth switching to one of those. But if you're not in the market for a switch, just sensible things, you know, check what the charges are before you travel. Always try and use Wi-Fi rather than data where you can. Download any sort of music or anything you want to listen to. I just think more generally people should be a bit more careful about using the internet when they travel. I think you always hear these stories about people, you know, posting pictures on the beach and then someone goes and burgles their house. Maybe it's just a bit of a cause to put your phone away a bit when you're on holiday and actually relax.
Honestly, Helen, fabulous advice. Simon shaking his head there, me thinking, what?
Sorry, excuse me, Helen, the 90s called and they want you back.
I've spent the last year just sitting in my house scrolling through Instagram, so I'm very much over it.
Ironically, actually, Vodafone has been one of the better providers to be with for some of these countries, because if you did have a contract with Vodafone, you could pay them like a certain amount for a kind of package that meant that everything was looped into it, and so you didn't have to worry about it. Whereas other providers didn't offer that. For example, my mobile phone is with Virgin, and they just don't offer that. So unless you're in Europe, it's going to be unbelievably expensive. So for example, in that crazy, crazy world where we were able to travel around the place and take pictures of ourselves on beaches, I went to Tel Aviv, and the charges for using data over there, or actually even texting and phoning, would have been monstrous on my mobile phone. So it was a Wi-Fi only job, or used my work phone, which is Vodafone and has that package involved in it. But people are going to get caught out because they're so used now to just being able to use their phone in Europe as they do at home, and it's not going to penetrate properly into people's minds. And I guarantee you that were you to do some proper analysis into it, you would find it will be the people who can least afford it who will disproportionately not be savvy and get hit by the biggest bills.
Always the way. Right, well, Helen mentioned there about Spotify, and we're going to stick with music because very interesting article on your website, Simon. Fleetwood Mac singer and keyboardist Christine McVie has become the fourth member of the legendary rock band to sell their back catalogue. I remember doing a school dance routine. Anyway, that means selling her rights to future royalties from 115 songs to music IP investment company Hipgnosis. I'm sure there's probably a much cooler way of saying it than that. Hipgnosis haven't said how much they've spent, but the firm has raised over $1 billion to buy the back catalogues of major artists such as Debbie Harry, Shakira, and the Red Hot Chili Peppers. They are not alone. It doesn't stop there. Bob Dylan, he also scored an estimated $300 million when he sold his back catalogue of 600 songs. Dolly Parton, Ozzy Osbourne, and Noel Gallagher, perhaps. I'm not sure how serious Noel Gallagher is, but considering to do it, he said he could sell his for as much as $200 million and use some of that money to buy a super yacht. If that's what you want to do, Noel, you crack on. Simon, what's going on here? And I ask that because, look, I'm no expert in this field. And maybe, and we're going to get on to emotional investing later on, I'm emotionally invested in this. I think Bob Dylan getting $300 million for his back catalogue of 600 songs, I think he was ripped off. I think they'd go for $1 billion. Come on. So you can educate me, Simon. One, what's going on here and why is it happening? And two, are they being ripped off or have I got no valuation? Am I just too emotionally invested in this area?
Okay, what's going on? Right. Firstly, as a music fan, I find this absolutely fascinating. As a music fan and an investor, what's going on is there's a bit of a gold rush for song rights. Now, song rights obviously are accrued by the people who wrote the songs. Hence the famous scenario where you have very famous singer or very famous song who makes no money and other person makes lots of money because they're the person who wrote the song. Now, what you've got going on is a number of different big investors who are buying up the rights to the music. And then when that music is played on the radio, when that music is streamed, when someone does a cover version of it, when that music is bought, if people are still buying the music, which they are, then they'll get some money. And if you think about it, if you can buy up the rights of very popular, enduring artists, that is a recurring income stream. And it was maybe a little bit of a missed opportunity because everybody went, well, the internet is just totally killing the music industry. You're not making anywhere near as much money as you did when you used to sell people a CD, right? Except streaming is big business. There are many, many, many people who are paying Spotify, paying Apple Music, paying other services. And although actually it's very hard for the average artist or the not so popular artists to really make any money from streaming, if you are someone who has got a back catalogue full of huge hits, then so many people listen to your music that you do have quite a large amount of money coming in. And what's happened is, as I said before, there's a number of investors who've been buying up these rights. And this investment trust, Hypnosis, started by a guy who worked in the music industry, Merck Mercuriadis. He used to manage a number of very, very famous artists. And he set up this investment trust. And it's the highest profile one, I would say, certainly in the UK. It's listed in London. And he has been buying up song rights. And if you look at the list of artists that he has bought the rights to, I mean, it's quite astonishing. You know, obviously, you listed some of them earlier there. But it's what he's doing is buying up these rights, but then also then trying to leverage that music to try and make it even more profitable. So they're putting these investors, including Merck Mercuriadis, are putting pressure on the streaming services to pay more money to, in terms of when stuff is played. But also they then do work in terms of trying to get songs into TV shows, into films, into commercials and things like that. And if you get a song into a TV show or a commercial or a viral video, then all of a sudden loads more people start streaming it. Now, I don't know how au fait you are with the charts, the top 40 at the moment, Georgie. How's your top 40 knowledge?
I haven't known about the top 40 since, what, about 1989?
No, right. So no. Top 40, my kids have got into the top 40. The top 40 is different to
what's
how it was
one?
When we were kids. What's number one at the moment? I don't know, but I was going to tell you what was number two until very recently.
How do you find out? Anyway, I'll find out, Simon. You tell me what was number two.
Well, you go to the top 40 and you listen really? To it. So Apple will do it on
the
Apple Music.
The internet wasn't around the last time I died.
I know. Sunday night, top 40. That was what it was. And you had two competing top 40s. You had the one that was on Radio 1 and you had the one that was on Capital. And sometimes they'd be different. Sometimes there'd be a different number one. Recording songs off the radio, onto your cassette player so you could listen back to them. I mean, those were the golden days of music. Nowadays, you just pick up your phone, you can listen to anything you want. Boring.
I can tell you, Simon. John, I was going to say this as well. It's Ed Sheeran. I mean, you'd pretty much be bang on if you said Ed Sheeran over the last 5 years. But Bad Habits, Ed Sheeran.
Yes, right. So
at least three songs in here I've heard of. This is amazing.
What was very near the top very recently for a long period of time, and I think still is Three Lions.
Let me tell you. I'm scrolling down.
It's probably
down.
Fallen out now. We're a fair way past the Euros, but it was
top,
up there.
It's not in the top 20.
And so that how's that effect happened? Well, it's happened because of the football tournament, obviously, and people just streaming the song and listening to it. So that demonstrates how a song can suddenly like get very, very popular. So say, for example, you get, there was that Fleetwood Mac song that was in the viral video that people kept filming of themselves after there was that old guy skateboarding down the street. All of a sudden, people start listening to that all the time. So the idea is that you can effectively, not only are you getting the income stream that comes from these bands, these artists, these songs being phenomenally popular anyway, and they're always going to remain popular. I mean, Fleetwood Mac are never going to stop being popular. But if you can then get more of those songs out there, more to people, to a new generation and a new audience, they're going to become even more popular. And you can also start trying to squeeze the streaming companies for more money. So anyway, people are getting paid huge amounts of money. Why are the artists selling? That's the big question, isn't it?
Yeah.
Well, hang on a minute. Like, isn't it a bit like selling out? The worst accusation you could make of anything that's cool, it's sold out. I mean, you are literally selling out. Mm. Well, I mean, if you are, for example, Christine McVeigh and you've sold this for, you know, tens of millions, or fellow band member Stevie Nicks estimated 80 to 100 million from selling an 80% share of her back catalogue in late 2020. Well, Stevie Nicks, she's still performing. She's still out there singing. I saw her a few years ago with Tom Petty in Hyde Park, which was absolutely brilliant. But she is coming probably towards the end of her career. She's getting older, and it happens to all of us, kind of thing. It's one last big payday. Same for Dylan, right? Why has Bob Dylan taken that money? I mean, Bob Dylan doesn't want to be accused of selling out, does he? But Bob Dylan, it's a huge amount of money, and it's a way of taking that money now while you're still alive, and you can then, you know, pass it on to whoever you want to, do whatever you want with it. Whereas if these artists die, with their rights intact, still owned by them, it's going to pass to whoever their estate passes to. And in many cases with some of these people, the estate gets disputed. We see this time and time again. Maybe it goes to people they don't want it to go to. Maybe it ends up in a big argument. Maybe they think it's just better to take the money, enjoy the money, give the money to who they want to give the money to, and cash in now. And also there is the possibility that because of all of the investors trying to buy up these rights, that the price has been bid up, and there's the suggestion that maybe this is peak what you can get kind of thing. But there's talk that Hypnosis, I think, are going to try to get the Red Hot Chili Peppers music. I don't think they've definitely bought it. But if you think about it, there's like some golden tickets, isn't there? I mean, that still haven't been picked up. It's like, imagine how much it would be worth if Jagger and Richards sold up the Rolling Stones back catalogue. I don't think they'd ever do that. But imagine what someone would pay for that.
Well, I still think someone would pay more than $300 million for Bob Dylan, but apparently not. Crystal ball gaze for me, Simon. What does this mean for the future of music? And also for investors that perhaps, you know, you and I, that want to get involved in this slice of music.
Well, I guess the thing that I find interesting here is not necessarily when you've got people like the members of Fleetwood Mac selling up. It's when you've got people who are more recent bands selling the rights. I mean, I know time passes quickly and Shakira and the Killers are probably a bit old hat to today's younger people, although my kids absolutely love Hips Don't Lie. But the Imagine Dragons, they've not been around that long, have they? You know, bands like people like that. And I think you're going to start seeing as more and more of the big legacy acts music is being bought up, you're probably going to see it filter down and some of the newer acts selling. And it's like, right, make a quick few million here, and then I'll go make some more music. And hopefully my next level of music be even more popular and so on and so on. It is a bit of a like commodification thing that we do tend to not like about stuff. But I mean, that is unfortunately the way of modern life. I think that as an investment, it's very interesting as an income investment. And it's also effectively very recession proof in the sense that you get that steady stream of income paying in. And some of the, you know, for example, the trust yielding like 4 or 5%, people are still going to be listening to music. I bet that there wasn't a wave of people suddenly cancelling Spotify and Apple Music as the pandemic struck. So it's quite a defensive investment in that sense. The question is whether the money they're paying for the actual rights themselves, the actual capital investment, is too high, or whether actually they're getting in at a good price and it's only going to get more expensive.
Right, well, that's it. It's the end of part one. We'll be back shortly after this.
This podcast is sponsored by eToro. And as at This Is Money, we always like to help you learn more. We've got Sam North of eToro to answer a quick question for us. Hello, Sam.
Hi, Simon. Pleasure to be here today.
Okay, Sam. And it's time for this podcast question. What are the common trading and investing mistakes that people make?
Well, I've mentored over 500 traders, so I feel in quite a good place to answer this. Common mistakes that newer traders and investors will make is that they risk too much on an investment. There is a saying, never risk more than you're afraid to lose, but I think newer traders should never risk more than, say, 2% of their account on an individual position. Other mistakes include revenge trading after a loss, feeling like the market owes you something when, of course, it doesn't. Also, having no plan as well is a common mistake. I really recommend traders and investors create a routine, create a journal, and review as much as possible to help their development.
Wise words. Thank you very much, Sam. And if you'd like to find out more about investing and trading, you can come to Sam's special webinar. To find out how to join that, go to thisismoney.co.uk/shareinvesting.
Welcome back. Now, we mentioned it a little bit earlier. Well, I did, because I was a little bit emotionally attached to music there. But are you too emotionally attached to your shares? Now, This Is Money have been exploring the endowment effect. Think bird in hand being better than two in a bush. With a behavioural finance expert. Now, while birds and bushes may work for things like parking spaces, I imagine, when it comes to investing, you may be doing yourself a little bit of a disservice. So how can you fight your own brain? Helen, I'm going to ask you, the endowment effect, what is it and how does it appear in personal finance? Because we're going to talk about investing, we'll get onto that in a sec, but I imagine it's across the board in how we behave with money, right?
Yeah, so it's sort of based on the idea that once you own something, you become attached to it. In this case, we're talking about stock market investments. And then the theory is that you'll then perhaps place a higher value on that maybe than it's necessarily really worth, or that people would be willing to pay for it. It's kind of it's a human nature thing. You know, you own something, you get attached to it, and then you think it's worth more than it perhaps is.
It means that you effectively a deep-rooted aversion to feeling a sense of loss. And so we hold on to something for longer than we should do. And we're keener to avoid losing the item than we are to acquire it. And so we put a higher value on it. Behavioral investing, that old thing. A study found that participants wanted $7.12 to sell a mug that they owned, which had no sentimental value, but would only pay $2.87 to buy the same mug when they didn't own it. So what are the signs that you're a sufferer? Well, you're just kind of holding on. You look down your portfolio and you're just kind of holding on to investments and saying, well, why have I still got these? And the question to ask yourself is, would I buy that at this price now? And if you wouldn't buy that at this price now, then maybe you shouldn't be holding it. And the ways to fight about it is to think about investment similar to the one that you own, but that's not in your portfolio. Say, right, well, would I buy it for this price? If you wouldn't buy it for that price, maybe you should sell the one in your portfolio, unless you consider it to be a superior investment for actual reasons. Consider the opportunity cost. So by holding fund A, you can't buy fund B because you have a limited amount of money. And take a look at your portfolio, work out whether you hold any emotional attachments to investments and why. Did you inherit them from a close family member? Did you used to work for that company? Did you buy that company because you liked its products and its services, but actually as an investment, it's really not very good? Did you buy it because you thought that it would help you in some way back sustainability, but actually when you look at it, it's not really sustainable at all? But you're just kind of holding on to it. Those are the kind of questions that you should be asking yourself, and then you should act. And the way to do this is probably not to be doing this on a constant basis. It's to sit down once or twice a year, look at your portfolio, see if you can export it to a spreadsheet or something, print it out or whatever, and just go through it line by line. Do I really want that investment? Is it any good? And if you can, like, you know, force yourself to make a note every time you buy something that says, this is why I bought it. And then you can look back at that note in the future and go, has that come true? Do I still believe it? Am I an idiot? And should I just dump this?
Yeah. I guess it might help speaking to a mate who's into investing, who can be a bit more dispassionate, or a financial expert, advisor. How do you know the difference between, or is there one, an endowment effect and sheer pigheadedness? And I'm thinking things like, let's say you've bought into cryptocurrency and you are damn sure you have made that right decision. Oh my goodness me, it's just plummeted, but it's okay. It's going to rise because I've just thrown a load of money into this. And I haven't, by the way, but this is an argument that some people have been throwing at me. How do you know the difference? Does it matter?
I don't think there's actually, well, there is a difference between the two, but there's not so much difference between the two. I think it's just another, maybe this being stubborn like that is just another example of the endowment effect. You know, stubbornness and pigheadedness and a refusal to acknowledge when things change is a bad way of investing. It's a bad way of doing stuff in general, but we are all guilty of it. And so that's something else to consider as well.
Now we're going to talk about fractional shares, if that's all right. If you wanted to buy just one of Amazon shares, it would set you back almost $2,500. However, there are some platforms that offer a way to back big ticket stocks for just a few quid. Now, it sounds interesting, but Simon, should you invest? Firstly, what's a fractional share?
It's a fraction of a share, Georgie.
That's what it says on the tin. Thought so.
That's what it says on the tin. No, look, so the thing is, as you said, it's going to cost you the best part of £2,500. Now, for most people, that's completely impractical. Firstly, they may not have enough money in order to buy one whole share. Secondly, even if they do, buying shares in whole amounts may prove to be not such a good idea for their portfolio because they're going to become way too exposed to just one company. Because let's face it, Amazon might be one of the world's biggest companies, but it's still only a very small part of the entire global stock market. And if you've ended up with, you know, even 10% of your portfolio held in Amazon shares, then you are very heavily weighted towards Amazon. And this is a problem that's common across a lot of those big US tech names. Actually, Berkshire Hathaway is the biggest problem, that would cost you hundreds of thousands of dollars to buy one share. That's Warren Buffett's company. But you've got Amazon, $3,342 when this article was written. A Tesla share, that's $713. And that is after Tesla did a stock split in order to make the, to bring the value of its shares down. Like, so you effectively, they turned one share into more than one share in order to make the share price cheaper. Even Apple, the largest company in the world, which has in the past done stock splits in order to try to bring its share price down, the ticket price of those shares down, that's $146. It makes it quite inaccessible. So you can buy fractional shares. And the way that works is with most investment platforms nowadays, they hold your money in a nominee account. And that means your money is actually pooled with other investors' money, and just a certain number of shares are assigned to your name. So if actually the person whose name is on the stock certificates, who actually has to buy the stocks, is that investment platform, then it doesn't, they can assign you like 1, 3, 5, 9, 7 whole number of shares, or they can actually assign you 1.5 or 0.5 or 0.3. It doesn't make any difference to them. It's just a number in a ledger. All they have to do is make sure that they hold a round number of shares, because they can't go buy fractional shares on the stock market directly themselves. But not everybody offers this. And I think that's, in this country, a legacy of the fact that actually share prices, the ticket price on shares, tends to be lower. So some of our biggest companies, for example, BP, is £3 a share, not an issue kind of thing. Even the companies with big share prices in this country tends to be like, you know, £24.50 or something like that. They don't tend to be unmanageable. So a lot of our DIY investing platforms, the big guns, the Hargreaves, the Interactive Investor, the AJ Bell, the Fidelity, etc. over here, they haven't tended to offer fractional shares. But you've seen the rise of these trading apps. And with that, you've seen a lot more interest in buying US shares. The interest is largely in buying the biggest companies, naturally, and the most high profile companies. And so as a way of enabling people to do this, companies such as eToro, such as Free Trade, such as Trading 212, are offering fractional share ownership. So as an investor, you might think, okay, well, that's a no-brainer. I mean, I might as well have the option to do that. Yeah. But actually, do you need to? I mean, because in all honesty, a lot of people don't buy individual shares. A lot of people don't buy individual US shares. So you might never need this functionality. A lot of people would be better off spreading their money around with investment trusts or ETFs or trackers or funds. And if you do go with some of these platforms, you may not be able to access all of those investments. So for example, quite a lot of the trading ones will only sell you stock market listed investments, and they may not have every stock market listed investment. Whereas if you go to a Hargreaves, an Interactive Investor, an AJ Bell or Fidelity, you can buy all the funds, investment trusts, ETFs that are out there. You will pay more money in dealing fees though, because that's the other thing with a lot of these trading and investing apps that have come out, is you pay less money in dealing fees. So I think you have to consider what you're going to invest in and how you're going to invest, and where the opportunity cost for you in choosing one platform or app over another might lie.
All right, then. Now, finally, confession time. Are you a super snooper? Apparently, nearly 60% of us Brits have tried to find out how much people we know have spent on buying their home. Now, being British, we think it's rude to ask someone outright, but apparently it's okay to stalk them online. I'm sure this is all legit research from Zoopla, but I have to say, a little bit dubious about the fact that apparently a quarter of people who've done this have apparently broken up with their partner after finding out how much their home costs. That seems a rather high number of people, and I don't know why you would do that. But either way, Helen, have you done this before? Simon, have you done this before? I don't think I have.
I think I've definitely been interested in how much people I know have paid for their houses, but also
diplomatic.
I'm a journalist, and I'm also just quite rude, so I think I would just ask them outright. So I've been looking to rent a new place recently, and in the sort of spirit of research, I just asked my friends how much they pay for their rent, because, you know, it's I want to know, and it benefits me. And I think people don't always mind talking about it, but no, I completely understand that most people aren't as rude as me and would rather do it secretly and online, and the person that they're snooping on would never find out.
I think your approach is far better, to be honest, rather than sort of online snoopery. Simon, have you ever online snooped?
All the time. Of course I have. It's like, you know, looking up house prices and how much people paid for houses, but not necessarily not targeted at my friends and family, I should say, or people I know, just in general, just a massive scattergun effect, because I'm just like, well, how much would it cost to live there? Wonder how much that house sold for. I mean, I'm the kind of person who's still got the right move alert set up and still looks at them even after buying a house, kind of thing, which is a dangerous game to play for a certain period of time, and then you can kind of relax, you're far enough away. But if, like, you know, 1 month after you bought the house, you're like, oh, I could have had that one, would have been so much better, kind of thing. But yeah, all the time, I'm always looking up. So you want Rightmove sold prices, Zoopla do sold prices as well. There's a couple of others that do it. You can look stuff up on the land registry if you can't find things there. You can look up title deeds. A lot of that has price paid data on it, but you will actually have to pay for those. Also, there's a couple of good ones where you can see asking price reductions. I think one called Property Tracker. It's a plugin for Chrome, and you can use it with Rightmove. So you can see if a property has had its price cut, it will usually say reduced on Rightmove, but it won't tell you by how much. If you download this, it will show you how much it's been cut by from the original one. So yeah, I mean, less kind of voyeuristic and snooping, more just general nosiness and interest. And in my defense, I have been writing about the property market for more than the last 15 years of my life. So as Helen said, there's kind of a it's our job justification, maybe.
All right, that's fine. No one's judging you, Simon. It's okay. Helen, why would you break up with someone after finding out how much their property was worth? Help me out on this one. My brain can't work it out. I mean, are they upset that it's too much and they've lied to them, or upset it's not enough and they think that they're poor? I mean, why would you break up with someone when you found out how much they paid for their property?
Yeah, so this survey from Zoopla is actually quite a worrying indictment on the state of people's relationships. So a third of people said they continue to date someone they would have otherwise ditched after they looked at the price of their house online.
Honest gold digging there, okay, fair
enough. Yeah, but a quarter of people said they dumped someone after seeing the value of their home. I mean, I don't know what that says. I mean, I suppose if you think about it in a broader sense, I suppose how much someone's house is worth can kind of give you a clue about maybe how responsible they are with money or how sort of well set up they are for different sort of life events. You know, if you want to start a family or you're thinking about how to fund your retirement, I mean, that's the only kind of sensible an explanation that I can think of for it that doesn't just make me think that people are awful.
I'm just thinking, is this like an addition to Tinder profiles that you need to have? Like, I'm double jabbed and my house is worth over 500,000. I mean, where are we going with
that? I want to say that I've got a question in my mind here as to whether the two were directly connected. Like, were people asked the question, did you break up with someone after you'd looked up how much their home was worth? And it's like, yeah, I did look up how much their home was worth, and I did then break up with them afterwards.
Right.
But I didn't break up with them because of that. I don't know. Is there a misanswering thing going on there? I do think that if you are one of those people who have been broken up with after your property snooping ex-partner looked up how much your home was worth and decided that they were going to break up with you, you're probably been done a massive favor.
Yeah.
Because
you dodged a bullet there, really.
You dodged a bullet. Yeah.
Helen, on just one final thing on this, you have a poll on your website. So I want to know if your readers correlate with the research. How many of them are super snoopers? And we're talking here not just looking up general house prices in your area. We're just talking about people you know, frenemies, people you hate, exes, and that sort of thing. How many of your readers are super snoopers?
So 58% of our readers said that they had tried to find out the house price of someone they know, and 42% said that they hadn't. So, you know, it's roughly in line with the Zoopla survey, and the majority of people have snooped on the house prices of their family and friends. So that's where we are. That's what we like to do.
Fair enough. Put up a poll next to it, though, about the have you broken up with someone as a direct result. But anyway, that's it for this week. You can keep up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. And if you have any comments or questions for the team, anything you'd like them to look into, or if you'd just like to tell us that you broke up with someone after stalking them online, Simon?
You can email us at editor@thisismoney.co.uk. You can tweet us at thisismoney, or you can come to thisismoney.co.uk/podcast to find all the podcasts past and join in the debate and read the comments.
Just want to be clear, it's okay to break up with someone if you stalk them online and something bad is about that. I'm not disagreeing with that behaviour. That's okay. I'm just talking about generally the correlation with the house price story, you know, just to put that out. And if you like our podcast, why not rate us on iTunes? It helps people find us.